General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT. Following World War II, GATT was the mechanism by which countries negotiated to bring down global tariffs and open the way for more trade. In the 8 rounds of GATT negotiations between 1948 and 1995, average tariffs in industrial countries fell from 40% to 4%. That's a massive reduction in the tax paid on all imported goods. It's also forced domestic producers to make their goods cheaper and better in order to stay competitive. If you walk into a car dealership today, you're better off than you were in 1970 for two reasons. First, there's a wider choice of excellent imports. Second, Detroit has responded slowly, belatedly, and incompletely by making better cars, too. The Honda Accord makes you better off, and so does the Ford Taurus, which is better than it would have been without the competition. Trade is good for poor countries, too. If we had patiently explained the benefits of trade to the protesters in Seattle or Washington or Davos or Genoa, then perhaps they would have laid down their Molotov cocktails. Okay, maybe not. The thrust of the anti-globalization protests has been that world trade is something imposed by rich countries on the developing world. If trade is mostly good for America, then it must be mostly bad for somewhere else. At this point in the book, we should recognize that zero-sum thinking is usually wrong when it comes to economics. So it is in this case. Representatives from developing nations were the ones who complained most bitterly about the disruption of the WTO talks in Seattle. Some believe that the Clinton administration secretly organized the protests to scuttle the talks and protect American interest groups, such as organized labor. Indeed, after the failure of the WTO talks in Seattle, UN Chief Kofi Annan blamed the developed countries for erecting trade barriers that exclude developing nations from the benefits of global trade and called for a global New Deal. The WTO's current round of talks to reduce global trade barriers, the Doha Round, has stalled in large part because a bloc of developing nations is demanding that the United States and Europe reduce their agricultural subsidies and trade barriers. So far, the rich countries have refused. Trade gives poor countries access to markets in the developed world. That's where most of the world's consumers are, or at least the ones with money to spend. Consider the impact of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, a law passed in 2000 that allowed Africa's poorest countries to export textiles to the United States with little or no tariff. Within a year, Madagascar's textile exports to the United States were up 120%. Malawi's were up 1,000%. Nigeria's were up 1,000%. And South Africa's were up 47%. As one commentator noted, real jobs for real people. Trade paves the way for poor countries to get richer. Export industries often pay higher wages than jobs elsewhere in the economy. But that's only the beginning. New export jobs create more competition for workers, which raises wages everywhere else. Even rural incomes can go up. As workers leave rural areas for better opportunities, there are fewer mouths to be fed from what can be grown on the land they leave behind. Other important things are going on, too. Foreign companies introduce capital, technology, and new skills. Not only does that make export workers more productive, it spills over into other areas of the economy. Workers learn by doing, and then take their knowledge with them. In his excellent book, The Elusive Quest for Growth, William Easterly tells the story of the advent of the Bangladeshi garment industry, an industry that was founded almost by accident. The Daewoo Corporation of South Korea was a major textile producer in the 1970s. America and Europe had slapped import quotas on South Korean textiles, so Daewoo, ever the profit-maximizing firm, skirted the trade restrictions by moving some operations to Bangladesh. In 1979, Daewoo signed a collaborative agreement to produce shirts with the Bangladeshi company Desh Garments. Most significant, Daewoo took 130 Desh workers to South Korea for training. In other words, Daewoo invested in the human capital of its Bangladeshi workers. The intriguing thing about human capital, as opposed to machines or financial capital, is that it can never be taken away. Once those Bangladeshi workers knew how to make shirts, they could never be forced to forget. And they didn't. Daewoo later severed the relationship with its Bangladeshi partner, but the seeds for a booming export industry were already planted. Of the 130 workers trained by Daewoo, 115 left during the 1980s to start their own garment exporting firms. Mr. Easterly argues convincingly that the Daewoo investment was an essential building block for what became a $3 billion garment export industry. Lest anyone believe that trade barriers are built to help the poorest of the poor, or that Republicans are more averse to protecting special interests than Democrats, it should be noted that the Reagan administration slapped import quotas on Bangladeshi textiles in the 1980s. I'd be hard-pressed to explain the economic rationale for limiting the export opportunities of a country that has a per capita GDP of $1,500. Most famously, cheap exports were the path to prosperity for the Asian tigers, Singapore, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, and for Japan before that. India was strikingly insular during the four decades after achieving independence from Britain in 1947. It was one of the world's great economic underachievers during that stretch. Alas, Gandhi, like Lincoln, was a great leader and a bad economist. Gandhi proposed that the Indian flag have a spinning wheel on it to represent economic self-sufficiency. India reversed course in the 1990s, deregulating its domestic economy and opening up to the world. The result is an ongoing economic success story. China, too, has used exports as a launching pad for growth. Indeed, if China's 30 provinces were counted as individual countries, the 20 fastest-growing countries in the world between 1978 and 1995 would all have been Chinese. To put that development accomplishment in perspective, it took 58 years for the GDP per capita to double in Britain after the launch of the Industrial Revolution. In China, GDP per capita has been doubling every 10 years. In the cases of India and China, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people being lifted out of poverty and increasingly into the middle class. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wooden, Asian correspondents for the New York Times for over a decade, have written, "We and other journalists wrote about the problems of child labor and oppressive conditions in both China and South Korea. But looking back, our worries were excessive. Those sweatshops tended to generate the wealth to solve the problems they created. If Americans had reacted to the horror stories in the 1980s by curbing imports of those sweatshop products, then neither southern China nor South Korea would have registered as much progress as they have today." China and Southeast Asia are not unique. The consultancy A.T. Kearney conducted a study of how globalization has affected 34 developed and developing countries. They found that the fastest globalizing countries had rates of growth that were 30 to 50% higher over the past 20 years than countries less integrated into the world economy. Those countries also enjoyed greater political freedom and received higher scores on the UN Human Development Index. The authors reckon that some 1.4 billion people escaped absolute poverty as a result of the economic growth associated with globalization. There was bad news, too. Higher rates of globalization were associated with higher rates of income inequality, corruption, and environmental degradation. More on that later. But there's an easier way to make the case for globalization. If not more trade and economic integration, then what instead? Those who oppose more global trade must answer one question, based on a point made by Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs. Is there an example in modern history of a single country successfully developing without trading and integrating with the global economy? No, there is not. Which is why Tom Friedman has suggested that the Anti-Globalization Coalition ought to be known as the Coalition to Keep the World's Poor People Poor. Trade is based on voluntary exchange. Individuals do things that make themselves better off. That obvious point is often lost in the globalization debate. McDonald's does not build a restaurant in Bangkok and then force people at gunpoint to eat there. People eat there because they want to, and if they don't want to, they don't have to. And if no one eats there, the restaurant will lose money and close. Does McDonald's change local cultures? Yes. That was what caught my attention a decade ago when I wrote about Kentucky Fried Chicken arriving in Bali. I wrote, Indonesians have their own version of fast food that's more practical than the Colonel's cardboard boxes and styrofoam plates. A meal bought at a food stall is wrapped in a banana leaf and newspaper. The large green leaf retains heat, is impermeable to grease, and can be folded into a neat package. By and large, the banana leaves of the world appear to be losing to cardboard. Not long ago, I attended a business gathering with my wife in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Puerto Vallarta is a lovely city that spills down from the hills to the Pacific Ocean. The focal point of the city is a promenade that runs along the ocean. Near the middle of that promenade is a point that juts out into the ocean. And at the end of that point, on what I would reckon is one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the city, is a Hooters restaurant. When our group spotted this infamous American export, one man grumbled, "That is just wrong." A Hooters in all the world's great cities is probably not what Adam Smith had in mind. University of Chicago professor Marvin Zonis has noted, "Certain aspects of American popular culture, the depravity and the coarseness, the violence and the sexuality, are eminently worth resenting." The threat of cultural homogenization, the worst of it coming from America, is a common knock against globalization. But it is an issue that leads us back to a crucial point from Chapter 1. Who decides? I wasn't happy to see a Hooters in Puerto Vallarta, but as I pointed out many pages ago, I don't run the world. More important, I don't live or vote in Puerto Vallarta. Neither do the rock-throwing thugs in Seattle or Genoa or Pittsburgh or wherever else they tend to show up. Are there legitimate reasons to limit the proliferation of fast food restaurants and the like? Yes, they present classic externalities. Fast food restaurants cause traffic and litter. They're ugly and can contribute to sprawl. Before my valuable work opposing a new train station on Fullerton Avenue, I was part of a group trying to prevent a McDonald's from moving in across the street. These are local decisions that ought to be made by the people affected. Those who might eat in the safe, clean environment of a McDonald's restaurant, as well as those who may have fast food wrappers blown in their gutters. Free trade is consistent with one of our most fundamental liberal values: the right to make our own private decisions. There's now a McDonald's in Moscow and a Starbucks in the Forbidden City in Beijing. Stalin never would have allowed the former. Mao would not have allowed the latter, which is a point worth pondering. The cultural homogenization argument may not be true anyway. Culture is transmitted in all directions. I can now rent Iranian movies from Netflix. National Public Radio recently ran a segment on craftsmen and artists in remote regions of the world who are selling their work via the Internet. One can log on to Novaka.com and find a virtual global marketplace for arts and crafts. Catherine Ryan, who works for Novaka, explains, "There's a community in Peru where most of the artists had gone to work in the coal mines. And now, because of the success of one artist in Novaka, He has been able to hire many of his family members and neighbors back into the weaving business, and they're no longer coal miners. They're now doing what for many generations their family did, and that's weave incredible tapestries. John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge, authors of the globalization tract A Future Perfect, point out that in the realm of business, a previously obscure Finnish company, like Nokia, has been able to thump American behemoths like Motorola. We're still just warming up when it comes to the side effects of globalization. A Hooters in Puerto Vallarta is a mild headache relative to the horrors of Asian sweatshops. Yet the same principles apply. Nike does not use forced labor in its Vietnamese factories. Why are workers willing to accept a dollar or two a day? Because it's better than any other option they have. According to the Institute for International Economics, the average wage paid by foreign companies in low-income countries is twice the average domestic manufacturing wage. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun described a visit with Mongkol Lolokorn, a Thai laborer whose 15-year-old daughter was working in a Bangkok factory making clothes for export to America. She is paid $2 a day for a 9-hour shift, 6 days a week. On several occasions, needles have gone through her hands, and managers have bandaged her up so that she could go back to work. "How terrible," we murmured sympathetically. Mongkol looked up, puzzled. "It's good pay," he said. "I hope she can keep that job. There's all this talk about factories closing now, and she said there are rumors that her factory might close. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't know what she would do then." The implicit message of the anti-globalization protests is that we, in the developed world, somehow know what is best for people in poor countries, where they ought to work, and even what kind of restaurants they ought to eat in. As The Economist has noted, the skeptics distrust governments, politicians, international bureaucrats, and markets alike. So they end up appointing themselves as judges, overruling not just governments and markets, but also the voluntary preferences of the workers most directly concerned. That seems a great deal to take on. The comparative advantage of workers in poor countries is cheap labor. That is all they have to offer. They're not more productive than American workers. They're not better educated. They do not have access to better technology. They're paid very little by Western standards because they accomplish very little by Western standards. If foreign companies are forced to raise wages significantly, then there's no longer any advantage to having plants in the developing world. Firms will replace workers with machines, or they'll move someplace where higher productivity justifies higher wages. If sweatshops paid decent wages by Western standards, they would not exist. There's nothing pretty about people willing to work long hours in bad conditions for a few dollars a day. But let's not confuse cause and effect. Sweatshops do not cause low wages in poor countries. Rather, they pay low wages because those countries offer workers so few other alternatives. Protesters might as well hurl rocks and bottles at hospitals, because so many sick people are suffering there. Nor does it make sense that we can make sweatshop workers better off by refusing to buy the products that they make. Industrialization, however primitive, sets in motion a process that can make poor countries richer. Mr. Kristof and Ms. Wudun arrived in Asia in the 1980s. Like most Westerners, we arrived in the region outraged at sweatshops, they recalled 14 years later. In time, though, we came to accept the view supported by most Asians, that the campaign against sweatshops risks harming the very people it is intended to help. For beneath their grime, sweatshops are a clear sign of the Industrial Revolution that is beginning to reshape Asia. After describing the horrific conditions, workers denied bathroom breaks, exposed to dangerous chemicals, forced to work 7 days a week, they conclude, "Asian workers would be aghast at the idea of American consumers boycotting certain toys or clothing in protest. The simplest way to help the poorest Asians would be to buy more from sweatshops, not less." You are not convinced? Paul Krugman offers a sad example of good intentions gone awry. In 1993, child workers in Bangladesh were found to be producing clothing for Walmart, and Senator Tom Harkin proposed legislation banning imports from countries employing underage workers. The direct result was that Bangladeshi textile factories stopped employing children. But did the children go back to school? Did they return to happy homes? Not according to Oxfam, which found that the displaced child workers ended up in even worse jobs or on the streets, and that a significant number were forced into prostitution. Oops! Preferences change with income, particularly with regard to the environment. Poor people care about different things than rich people do. By global standards, poor does not mean settling for a Ford Fiesta when you really wanted the BMW. Poor is watching your children die of malaria because you couldn't afford the $5 mosquito net. In parts of the world, $5 is 5 days of income. By those same standards, anyone reading this book is rich. The fastest way to end any meaningful discussion of globalization is to wave the environment card. But let's do a simple exercise to illustrate why it may be terribly wrong to impose our environmental preferences on the rest of the world. Here's the task. Ask 4 friends to name the world's most pressing environmental problem. It's a fair bet that at least 2 of them will say global warming, and none will mention clean water. Yet, inadequate access to safe drinking water, a problem easily cured by rising living standards, kills 2 million people a year and makes another 500 million seriously ill. Is global warming a serious problem? Yes. Would it be your primary concern if children in your town routinely died from diarrhea? No. The first fallacy related to trade and the environment is that poor countries should be held to the same environmental standards as the developed world. The debate over workplace safety is nearly identical. Producing things causes waste. I remember the first day of an environmental economics course when visiting Professor Paul Portney, former head of resources for the future, pointed out that the very act of staying alive requires that we produce waste. The challenge is to weigh the benefits of what we produce against the costs of producing it, including pollution. Someone living comfortably in Manhattan may view those costs and benefits differently from someone living on the brink of starvation in rural Nepal. Thus, trade decisions that affect the environment in Nepal ought to be made in Nepal, recognizing that environmental problems that cross political boundaries will be settled the same way they always are, which is through multilateral agreements and organizations. The notion that economic development is inherently bad for the environment may be wrong anyway. In the short run, just about any economic activity generates waste. If we produce more, we will pollute more. Yet, it's also true that as we get richer, we pay more attention to the environment. Here's another quiz. In what year did air quality in London, the city for which we have the best long-term pollution data, reach its worst level ever? To make it easier, let's narrow the choices. 1890, 1920, 1975, 2001. The answer is 1890. Indeed, the city's current air quality is better than at any time since 1585. There's nothing particularly clean about cooking over an open fire. Environmental quality is a luxury good in the technical sense of the word, which means that we place more value on it as we get richer. Therein lies one of the powerful benefits of globalization. Trade makes countries richer. Richer countries care more about environmental quality and have more resources at their disposal to deal with pollution. Economists reckon that many kinds of pollution rise as a country gets richer, when every family buys a motorcycle, and then fall in the later stages of development, when we ban leaded gasoline and require more efficient engines. Critics of trade have alleged that allowing individual countries to make their own environmental decisions will lead to a race to the bottom, in which poor countries compete for business by despoiling their environments. It hasn't happened. The World Bank recently concluded, after 6 years of study, pollution havens, developing countries that provide a permanent home to dirty industries, have failed to materialize. Instead, poorer nations and communities are acting to reduce pollution because they've decided that the benefits of abatement outweigh the costs. Climate change is a trickier case, in that carbon emissions are a zero-sum situation, at least in developing countries in the near term. Big, rapidly growing countries like China and India have a voracious appetite for energy. To meet that need, they turn mostly to carbon-based fuels. China is heavily dependent on coal, which is a particularly bad CO2 offender. Trade makes these countries richer. As they get richer, they will use more energy. As they use more energy, their CO2 emissions will rise. That's a problem. So, what's the best remedy? If you think it is to curtail trade, let me present a slightly different version of the same basic challenge. China and India are sending more and more of their citizens to university, while extending basic education more widely, too. Education is making China and India richer. As they get richer, they use more energy. Do you see where this is going? Should we ban education? No. The answer to the CO2 problem is to promote growth in India, China, the United States, and everywhere else, in ways that minimize the environmental damage. The best way to do that is to discourage the use of dirty fuels by imposing some kind of carbon tax that's harmonized across countries. Sooner rather than later, because India and China are making development decisions, such as building power plants, that are going to be with us for 50 years. The case for keeping people poor because it's good for the planet is economically and morally bankrupt. Poverty is a bitch. The principal of a high school near Chicago's Robert Taylor Housing Projects once told me that when I was writing a story on urban education. He was talking about the challenges of teaching kids who had grown up poor and deprived. He might as well have been talking about the state of the world. Many parts of the world, places we rarely think about, let alone visit, are desperately poor. We ought to make them richer. Economics tells us that trade is an important way to do it. Paul Krugman has nicely summarized the anxiety over globalization with an old French saying, "Anyone who is not a socialist before he is 30 has no heart. Anyone who is still a socialist after he is 30 has no head." He writes, "If you buy a product made in a third world country, it was produced by workers who are paid incredibly little by Western standards and probably work under awful conditions. Anyone who is not bothered by those facts at least some of the time has no heart. But that doesn't mean the demonstrators are right. On the contrary, anyone who thinks that the answer to world poverty is simple outrage against global trade has no head, or chooses not to use it. The anti-globalization movement already has a remarkable track record of hurting the very people and causes it claims to champion." The trend toward more global trade is often described as an unstoppable force. It is not. We've been down this road before, only to have the world trading system torn apart by war and politics. One of the most rapid periods of globalization took place during the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge, authors of A Future Perfect, have noted, "Look back 100 years and you discover a world that by many economic measures was more global than it is today. Where you could travel without a passport, where the gold standard was an international currency, and where technology, cars, trains, ships, and telephones were making the world enormously smaller." Alas, they point out, that grand illusion was shot to pieces on the playing fields of the sum. political boundaries still matter. Governments can slam the door on globalization as they have before. That would be a shame for rich countries and poor countries alike. Chapter 13. Development Economics. The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. Let us briefly contemplate the life of Nashon Zimba, a 25-year-old man who lives with his wife and baby daughter in Malawi. There's no question that Mr. Zimba is a hard-working man. He built his own home, as the economist describes. He digs up mud, shapes it into cuboids, and then dries it in the sun to make bricks. He mixes his own cement, also from mud. He cuts branches to make beams and thatches the roof with sisal or grass. His only industrial input is the metal blade on his axe. Working on his own, while at the same time growing food for his family, Mr. Zimba has erected a house that is dark, cramped, cold in the winter, steamy in the summer, and has running water only when tropical storms come through the roof. For all that work, Mr. Zimba is a poor man. His cash income in 2000 was roughly $40. He's hardly alone. Malawian GDP per capita was less than $200 at the time that story was written. Even today, the nation's entire annual economic output is only about $12 billion, or about half the size of Vermont's economy. Lest anyone naively believe that there's something pleasantly simple about this existence, it should be pointed out that 30% of young children in Malawi are malnourished. More than 2 of every 10 children will die before they reach their 5th birthday. According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, there are 1 billion people in the world who don't get enough to eat. The vast majority are in the developing world. Roughly half are in India and China. How is that possible? At a time when we can split the atom, land on the moon, and decode the human genome, why do 2 billion people live on less than $2 a day? The short answer is that their economies have failed them. At bottom, creating wealth is a process of taking inputs, including human talent, and producing things of value. Poor economies are not organized to do that. In his excellent book on economic development, The Elusive Quest for Growth, World Bank economist William Easterly describes a street scene in Lahore, Pakistan. People throng the markets in the old city, where the lanes are so narrow that the crowds swallow the car. People buying, people selling, people eating, people cooking. Every street, every lane crammed with shops, each shop crammed with people. This is a private economy with a lot of dynamism. It's also, he notes, a country that is largely illiterate, ill-housed, and ill-fed. The Pakistani government has built nuclear weapons, but is unable to conduct an immunization program against measles. Wonderful people, writes Mr. Easterly. Terrible government. And it's a terrible government that has become increasingly dangerous for the rest of the world. We can probably safely ignore Malawi. Not Pakistan. Every country has resources, if only the wits and hard work of the people who inhabit it. Most countries, including some of the poorest nations on earth, have far more resources than that. Let me get the bad news out of the way. Economists do not have a recipe for making poor countries rich. True, there have been some fabulous success stories, such as the original Asian Tigers, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan, which saw their economies grow more than 8% a year for nearly 3 decades. China and India have had a terrific decade, much to the benefit of hundreds of millions of people. But we don't have a proven formula for growth that can be rolled out in country after country, like some kind of development franchise. Just think about China and India. One is the world's largest democracy. The other is not democratic at all. On the other hand, we do have a good understanding of what makes rich countries rich. If we can catalog the kinds of policies that functional economies have in common, then we can turn our attention to Nobel laureate Douglas North's common sense query, why don't poor countries simply adopt policies that make for plenty? The following is a sample of the kinds of policies, and in some cases, lucky geographical endowments, that development economists have come to believe make the difference between the wealth and poverty of nations. Effective government institutions. To grow and prosper, a country needs laws, law enforcement, courts, basic infrastructure, a government capable of collecting taxes, and a healthy respect among the citizenship for each of these things. These kinds of institutions are the tracks on which capitalism runs. They must be reasonably honest. Corruption is not merely an inconvenience, as it is sometimes treated. It's a cancer that misallocates resources, stifles innovation, and discourages foreign investment. While American attitudes toward government range from indifference to hostility, most other countries would love to have it so good, as New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman has pointed out. I took part in a seminar 2 weeks ago at Nanjing University in China, and I can still hear a young Chinese graduate student pleading for an answer to her question. How do we get rid of all our corruption? Do you know what your average Chinese would give to have a capital like Washington today, with its reasonably honest and efficient bureaucracy? Do you know how unusual we are in the world, that we don't have to pay off bureaucrats to get the simplest permit issued? The relationship between government institutions and economic growth prompted a clever and intriguing study. Economists Daron Acemoglu, Simon Johnson, and James Robinson hypothesized that the economic success of developing countries that were formerly colonized has been affected by the quality of the institutions that their colonizers left behind. The European powers adopted different colonization policies in different parts of the world, depending on how hospitable the area was to settlement. In places where Europeans could settle without serious hardship, such as the United States, the colonizers created institutions that have had a positive and long-lasting effect on economic growth. In places where Europeans could not easily settle because of a high mortality rate from disease, such as the Congo, the colonizers simply focused on taking as much wealth home as quickly as possible, creating what the authors refer to as extractive states. The study examined 64 ex-colonies and found that as much as three-quarters of the difference in their current wealth can be explained by differences in the quality of their government institutions. In turn, the quality of those government institutions is explained, at least in part, by the original settlement pattern. The legal origin of the colonizers, British, French, Belgian, had little influence. Though the British come out looking good because they tended to colonize places more hospitable to settlement. Basically, good governance matters. The World Bank rated 150 countries on 6 broad measures of governance, such as accountability, regulatory burden, rule of law, graft, corruption, etc. There was a clear and causal relationship between better governance and better development outcomes, such as higher per capita incomes, lower infant mortality, and higher literacy. We don't have to love the Internal Revenue Service, but we ought to at least offer it some grudging respect. Property rights. Private property may seem like a province of the rich. In fact, it can have a crucial impact on the poor. The developed world is full of examples of informal property rights, homes or businesses built on land that is communal or owned by the government and ignored, such as the shanty towns on the outskirts of many large cities. Families and entrepreneurs make significant investments in their properties, but there's a crucial difference between those assets and their counterparts in the developed world. The owners have no legal title to the property. They cannot legally rent it, subdivide it, sell it, or pass it on to family. Perhaps most important, they cannot use it as collateral to raise capital. Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto has argued convincingly that these kinds of informal property arrangements should not be ignored. He reckons that the total value of property held but not legally owned by poor people in the developing world is worth more than $9 trillion. That's a lot of collateral gone to waste, or dead capital, as he calls it. To put that number in perspective, it's 93 times the amount of development assistance that the rich countries provided to the developing world over the past 3 decades. The Economist tells the story of a Malawian couple who make a living slaughtering goats. Since business is good, they'd like to expand. To do so, however, would require an investment of $250, or $50 more than the average annual income in Malawi. This couple owns a home worth more than that. Might they borrow against the value of their land and the bungalow they've built on it? No. The home is built on customary land that has no formal title. The couple is a contract signed by the local village chief, but is not enforceable in a court of law. The Economist goes on to note, about 2/3 of the land in Malawi is owned this way. People usually till the land their parents tilled. If there is a dispute about boundaries, the village chief adjudicates. If a family offends gravely against the rules of the tribe, the chief can take their land away and give it to someone else. Those informal property rights are like barter. They work fine in a simple agrarian society, but are woefully inadequate for a more complex economy. It's bad enough that poor countries are poor. It's all the worse that their most valuable assets are rendered less productive than they might be. Property rights have another less obvious benefit. They enable people to spend less time defending their possessions, which frees them up to do more productive things. Between 1996 and 2003, the Peruvian government issued property rights to 1.2 million urban squatter households, giving them formal ownership to what they had previously informally claimed as their own. Harvard economist Erica Field determined that property rights enabled residents to work more hours in the formal labor market. She surmises that property rights give more flexibility to people who previously had to stay home, or had to operate improvised businesses out of their home in order to protect their property. She also makes another important point. Most programs designed to help the poor reduce their work effort. This is the Samaritan's dilemma. If I ease your hardship, you have less incentive to help yourself. Providing formal property rights does the opposite. It encourages work. No excessive regulation. Government has plenty to do, and even more that it should not do. Markets must do the heavy lifting. Let's talk about Articles 575 and 615 of the Russian Civil Code. These regulations would be very important if you were a firm in Moscow doing something as simple as installing a vending machine. Article 575 forbids firms from giving anything away free, which includes the space that a firm gives to Coca-Cola when a vending machine is installed. Meanwhile, Article 615 forbids subletting property without the landlord's consent. The square meter taken up by the vending machine can be construed as a sublease. In addition, the tax collector forbids commercial enterprises, for example vending machines, to operate without a cash register. And since selling soft drinks from a machine constitutes retail trade, there are assorted fire, health, and safety inspections. Excessive regulation goes hand in glove with corruption. Government bureaucrats throw up hurdles so that they can extort bribes from those who seek to get over or around them. Installing a vending machine in Moscow becomes much easier if you hire the right security firm. What about opening a business elsewhere in the developed world? Again, Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto has done fascinating work. He and fellow team members documented their efforts to open a one-person clothing stall on the outskirts of Lima as a legally registered business. He and his researchers vowed that they'd not pay bribes so that their efforts would reflect the full cost of complying with the law. In the end, they were asked for bribes on 10 occasions and paid them twice to prevent the project from stalling completely. The team worked 6 hours a day for 42 weeks in order to get 11 different permits from 7 different government bodies. Their efforts, not including the time, cost $1,231, or 31 times the monthly minimum wage in Peru, all to open a one-person shop. Chapter 4 outlined all the reasons government should stick to the basics. Harvard economist Robert Barrow's classic study of economic growth in roughly 100 countries over 3 decades found that government consumption, total government spending excluding education and defense, was negatively correlated with per capita GDP growth. He concluded that such spending and the required taxation is not likely to increase productivity and will therefore do more harm than good. The Asian Tigers, the All-Star team in the Economic Development League, made their economic ascent with government spending in the range of 20% of GDP. Elsewhere in the world, high tax rates that are applied unevenly distort the economy and provide opportunities for graft and corruption. Many poor governments might actually collect more revenue if they implemented taxes that were low, simple, and easy to collect. The Internet has a huge potential to improve transparency everywhere, but particularly in poor countries. Something as simple as posting online the amount of money allocated by the central government for a specific local project, such as a road or a health clinic, can enable citizens to compare what they were supposed to get to what actually showed up. We got $5,000 for a community center. That doesn't look like a $5,000 community center. Let's go talk to the mayor. Human capital. Human capital is what makes individuals productive, and productivity is what determines our standard of living. As University of Chicago economist and Nobel laureate Gary Becker has pointed out, all countries that have had persistent growth in income have also had large increases in the education and training of their labor forces. We have strong reasons to believe that the education causes the growth, not the other way around. He's written, "These so-called Asian tigers grew rapidly by relying on a well-trained, educated, hard-working, and conscientious labor force." In poor countries, human capital does all the good things we would expect, and then some. Education can improve public health, which is, in turn, a form of human capital. Some of the most pernicious public health problems in the developing world have relatively simple fixes. Boiling water, digging latrines, using condoms, etc. Higher rates of education for women in developing countries are associated with lower rates of infant mortality. Meanwhile, human capital facilitates the adoption of superior technologies from developed countries. One cause for optimism in the development field has always been that poor countries should, in theory, be able to narrow the gap with richer nations by borrowing their innovations. Once a technology is invented, it can be shared with poor countries at virtually no cost. The people of Ghana need not invent the personal computer in order to benefit from its existence. They do need to know how to use it. Now, for more bad news. In Chapter 6, I described an economy in which skilled workers generate economic growth by creating new jobs or doing old jobs better. Skills are what matter, for individuals and for the economy as a whole. That's still true, but there's a glitch when we get to the developing world. Skilled workers usually need other skilled workers in order to succeed. Someone who's trained as a heart surgeon can succeed only if there are well-equipped hospitals, trained nurses, firms that sell drugs and medical supplies, and a population with sufficient resources to pay for heart surgery. Poor countries can become caught in a human capital trap. If there are few skilled workers, then there's less incentive for others to invest in acquiring skills. Those who do become skilled find that their talents are more valuable in a region or country with a higher proportion of skilled workers, creating the familiar brain drain. As World Bank economist William Easterly has written, the result can be a vicious cycle. If a nation starts out skilled, it gets more skilled. If it starts out unskilled, it stays unskilled. As a side note, this phenomenon is relevant in rural America, too. Not long ago, I wrote a story for The Economist that we referred to internally as the incredible Shrinking Iowa. As the working title would suggest, parts of Iowa and other large swaths of the rural Midwest are losing population relative to the rest of the country. Remarkably, 44 of Iowa's 99 counties had fewer people in 2000 than they had in 1900. Part of that depopulation stems from rising farm productivity. Iowa's farmers have literally grown themselves out of jobs. But something else is going on, too. Economists have found that individuals with similar skills and experience can earn significantly higher wages in urban areas than they can elsewhere. Why? One plausible explanation is that specialized skills are more valuable in metropolitan areas where there's a density of other workers with complementary skills. Think Silicon Valley or a cardiac surgery center in Manhattan. Rural America has a mild case of something that deeply affects the developing world. Unlike technology or infrastructure or pharmaceuticals, we cannot export huge quantities of human capital to poor countries. We cannot airlift 10,000 university degrees to a small African nation. Yet, as long as individuals in poor countries face limited opportunities, they'll have a diminished incentive to invest in human capital. How does a country break out of the trap? Remember that question when we come to the importance of trade. Geography. Here's a remarkable figure. Only 2 of 30 countries classified by the World Bank as rich, Hong Kong and Singapore, lie between the Tropic of Cancer, which runs through Mexico, across North Africa, and through India, and the Tropic of Capricorn, which runs through Brazil and across the northern tip of South Africa and through Australia. Geography may be a windfall that we, in the developed world, take for granted. Development expert Jeffrey Sachs wrote a seminal paper in which he posited that climate can explain much of the world's income distribution. He writes, "Given the varied political, economic, and social histories of regions around the world, it must be more than coincidence that almost all of the tropics remain underdeveloped at the start of the 21st century. The United States and all of Europe lie outside the tropics. Most of Central and South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia lie within. Tropical weather is wonderful for vacation. Why is it so bad for everything else? The answer, according to Mr. Sachs, is that high temperatures and heavy rainfall are bad for food production and conducive to the spread of disease. As a result, 2 of the major advances in rich countries, better food production and better health, cannot be replicated in the tropics. Why don't the residents of Chicago suffer from malaria? Because cold winters control mosquitoes, not because scientists have beaten the disease. So, in the tropics, we find yet another poverty trap. Most of the population is stuck in low-productivity farming. Their crops, and therefore their lives, are unlikely to get better in the face of poor soil, unreliable rainfall, and chronic pests. Obviously, countries cannot pick up and move to more favorable climates. Mr. Sachs proposes 2 solutions. First, we ought to encourage more technological innovation aimed at the unique ecology of the tropics. The sad fact is that scientists, like bank robbers, go where the money is. Pharmaceutical companies earn profits by developing blockbuster drugs for consumers in the developed world. Of the 1,233 new medicines granted patents between 1975 and 1997, only 13 were for tropical diseases. But even that overstates the attention paid to the region. 9 of those drugs came from research done by the U.S. military for the Vietnam War or from research for the livestock and pet market. How do we make private companies care as much about sleeping sickness, on which no major company is doing research, as they do about canine Alzheimer's, for which Pfizer already has a drug? Change the incentives. In 2005, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown embraced an idea that economists have long kicked around. Identify a disease that primarily afflicts a poor part of the world, and then offer a large cash prize to the first firm that develops a vaccine that meets predetermined criteria. For example, is effective, is safe for use in children, doesn't need refrigeration, etc. Brown's plan was actually more sophisticated. He proposed that rich governments pre-commit to buying a certain number of doses of the winning vaccine at a certain price. Poor people would get life-saving drugs. The pharmaceutical company would get what it needs to justify the vaccine research, a return on investment, just as it does when developing drugs that consumers in rich countries will buy. The British government has been thinking this way for a long time. In 1714, after 2,000 sailors drowned when a fleet got lost, crashed into the rocky coast and sunk, the British government offered £20,000 to anyone who developed an instrument for measuring longitude at sea. The prize led to the invention of the chronometer. The other hope for poor countries in the tropics, says Mr. Sachs, is to step out of the trap of subsistence agriculture by opening their economies to the rest of the world. He notes, if the country can escape to higher incomes via non-agricultural sectors, for example, through a large expansion of manufactured exports, the burdens of the tropics can be lifted. Which brings us once again to our old friend, trade. Openness to trade. We've had a whole chapter on the theoretical benefits of trade. Suffice it to say that those lessons have been lost on governments in many poor countries in recent decades. The fallacious logic of protectionism is alluring. The idea that keeping out foreign goods will make the country richer. Strategies such as self-sufficiency and state leadership were hallmarks of the post-colonial regimes, such as India and much of Africa. Trade barriers would incubate domestic industries so that they could grow strong enough to face international competition. Economics tells us that companies shielded from competition do not grow stronger. They grow fat and lazy. Politics tells us that once an industry is incubated, it will always be incubated. The result, in the words of one economist, has been a largely self-imposed economic exile. At great cost, it turns out. The preponderance of evidence suggests that open economies grow faster than closed economies. In one of the most influential studies, Jeffrey Sachs, now director of the Earth Institute of Columbia University, and Andrew Warner, a researcher at the Harvard Center for International Development, compared the economic performance of closed economies, as defined by high tariffs and other restrictions on trade, to the performance of open economies. Among poor countries, the closed economies grew at 0.7% per capita annually during the 1970s and 1980s, while the open economies grew at 4.5% annually. Most interesting, when a previously closed economy opened up, growth increased by more than a percentage point a year. To be fair, some prominent economists have taken issue with the study on the grounds, among other quibbles, that economies closed to trade often have a lot of other problems, too. Is it the lack of trade that makes these economies grow slowly? Or is it general macroeconomic dysfunction? For that matter, does trade cause growth, or is it something that just happens while economies are growing for other reasons? After all, The number of televisions sold rises sharply during extended spells of economic growth, but watching television does not make countries richer. Conveniently for us, a recent paper in the American Economic Review, one of the most respected journals in the field, is entitled